Before Art Spiegelman burst into international prominence with the publication of his Pulitzer Prize-winning graphic novel, Mouse, he was a star in the comics world because of works like Breakdowns, a collection of experimental comic strips in 1978 that helped to reinvent the medium. Now he's reissued the long-out-of-print Breakdowns with a new introduction and epilogue of autobiographical vignettes showing the people, experiences, and comics that help shape his life. It's being published by Pantheon. And Toon Books has just released Jack in the Box, what Art calls a first comic for brand new readers. I'm pleased that they bring Art Spiegelman back to the show. Hi, Art. It's always a pleasure to see you.
Hi. Thanks for having me again.
How was Breakdowns received when it was first published in 1978?
Oh, I would say received is probably like overreaching. It was there. Nobody. It was privished. It was printed rather than published, and it took years to find any audience. It didn't. It was anomalous. There was nothing remotely in its category, like a hardcover comic that had no humor, no characters that you'd revisit. It was just short experimental strips. The only person clamoring for this was me.
But it's about your move from the underground to the mainstream as a comic artist. So you had decided to write memoir in a comic form?
Well, gee, that was part of it. But the Breakdown strips were the ones where I first found my voice as a cartoonist in a world where I was like a freshman among the seniors who were the Zap cartoonists in San Francisco.
People like Robert Crumb.
Exactly, you know. And for a while I was imitating them, and then I found my own voice, let's say, as a cartoonist. But I needed to see the work outside the context of the ephemeral underground comics where, like, the comics I was making that got gathered in Breakdowns were comics meant to be reread rather than read. And the Zap type comics, you'd only reread because you were too stoned to turn the page, you know. So
the first time.
So here I just needed to see what it would be to understand it. And it was, some of it was autobiographical, like you said, memoir related, and at the beginnings of that as a possibility for comics. And the rest were sort of experimental, formal works of one kind.
But it's kind of like personal essay as well. Everything that comics weren't doing at that time.
Yeah. Like the first thing that they hadn't been doing is busting every taboo possible. And I climbed in late to that, but did my best.
Did you actually say to yourself, I'm going to do all the stuff that comics don't do?
Well, in a sense, it was like, well, comics can do a lot more than this, and I want to see what it can be. And basically, I guess I realize now what it is, which is that Chris Ware, another great cartoonist, put it this way. He said, if you read a comic and you don't understand it, you assume the cartoonist is stupid. If you see a painting, you assume you're stupid. So I wanted to rearrange the contract so you could meet in the middle. You could do stuff that would require a more attentive audience than comics were used to getting.
And you describe it as, quote, a manifesto, a diary, a crumpled suicide note, and a still relevant love letter to a medium I adore. When did you realize that it had served all those functions? At the time or when you looked at these things many years later?
Well, I think the suicide note has been an ongoing leitmotif. The love letter has been an ongoing leitmotif. But a lot of it came together when I was trying to understand what it would mean to put the book out again, because it had a very small print run, even though each of the individual strips were kind of influential in their own weird ways when they got first printed in Underground Comics or reissued.
Yeah, they were published piecemeal.
Yeah. But when I was trying to look at this book again after 30 years later, it really did require a recontextualization, because even though it made a lot happen in its own weird way, including Raw Magazine and the Mouse book and everything like that, there was also like just trying to like position it for people to understand what it is, because it doesn't feel like the other comics even coming out now.
Well, you actually refer to Mouse in one of these comics, but those are the early Mouse cartoons rather than the book itself?
Well, there was a three-page Mouse that I did for a comic called Funny Aminals, which was an underground comic that Crumb did the cover of. For me, that was a big deal to be in a book that Robert had blessed with a cover.
He was one of your influences.
He was, yeah. And Crumb did a story about these two little fox boys who get this big-legged chicken girl, and they gets her up to their room, and then, of course, they eat her. Not in any kind of FCC-disapproved way, but she's a chicken, they're foxes, he ate her. So the only requirement was to do something that used anthropomorphic characters, and through a series of twists and turns, I ended up making a three-page comic that had the basic concept of what became the Mouse books later.
And did you have a sense when you were doing that you were creating something that would be considered groundbreaking later?
Well, in the sense that it's where
you wrote about the Holocaust using pigs and mice and other animals.
So it was that strip in which I sort of found my own voice as a cartoonist, let's say. And I knew it was unfinished business. The three pages didn't begin to cover it back in 72 when I did the three-page strip. There wasn't even a Hollow Kitsch industry like we've got now. There was just a hush, a silence. So in 78, when this Breakdowns book first came out and couldn't find any audience worth knowing, I realized, well, the next thing to do is just go back to that Mao strip and re-inhabit that. But it's the strip I did after Mao's that's the second piece in the Breakdowns book, which was about my mother's suicide.
Prisoner on the Hell Planet.
Yeah, that's where I found not just subject matter that I found congenial is the wrong word when you're dealing with the Holocaust, but appropriate. The strip about my mother's suicide.
And your nervous breakdown.
Yes. It's called Breakdowns for two reasons. A, I had one, and B, it's the technical term for the little layouts for a page in comics.
And it really is stunning because it is a personal essay, memoir, only illustrated box by box.
Yeah, and even illustration doesn't begin to kind of fully nail it because the pictures and words are functioning in ways beyond what an illustrator would. They're not embellishments, let's say. They're part of the way the story moves. And in the Hell Planet strip specifically, I was finding a visual vocabulary that wasn't part of comics so much. It was like off that German expressionist Neue Sachlichkeit kind of art of Gross, Beckmann, and others. And the breakdowns weren't like the most natural kind of page layouts that were invisibly just box after box.
And any number of modern cartoonists have realized that the Germans were doing something that was close to cartooning way back before Hitler came to power.
Yeah, well, I think as soon as I got over my slob snob self, which is the only good culture could exist in comics, everything else was a racket and a sham. And it took an underground filmmaker pal, Ken Jacobs, to kind of show me that basically Picasso was just doing large cartoon panels, lighten up and take a look.
And you've included a lot of Picasso images in your work over the years.
Yeah, there's one of the strips, probably the longest thing in this collection of disparate short things, is a strip called Ace Hole, in which I have the femme fatale Lauren Bacall noir woman in a noir-like comic using a midget detective. She's sort of based on Dora Maar's and is drawn that way.
My guest is Art Spiegelman. We're talking about two books that have just come out of his, Breakdowns, which is published by Pantheon, the publisher of Mouse, and his own publishing company, Toon Books, has just released Jack in the Box, a book for beginning readers. It's a weird kind of thing because one is says for adults only, and the other one says for beginning readers only.
Yes, exactly. Like I realized when I was put in that mental hospital with the breakdown, I was diagnosed as schizophrenic, and now 30 years later I get to prove it with two books that seem like they're from other ends of the spectrum.
What led you to study with Ken Jacobs? Were you one of those people who believed that if you understand how a film is done, you'll understand how a cartoon should be done?
Well, it was much less premeditated than that. I fell into Binghamton, New York, a school that had kicked me out, but about 15 years ago offered me an honorary degree. And when I was just bumming around there, Ken had just started teaching there. I started sitting in on his classes, and it was just unlocked other ways of looking. And I think that Ken is one of these people who, if he was teaching painting or film or whatever else, it was the looking with fresh eyes that became really important.
And now he and his wife are the subject of a film by their son.
Yeah, Mama's Boy by Azazel Jacobs.
You say the best advice you've ever gotten as a cartoonist.
Mama's Man, sorry.
Yeah, I forgot.
Yeah.
You said the best advice you've ever gotten as a cartoonist came from your father. What was that?
Oh, well, you know, as a kid, he'd always try to, like, make me help him. And for me, this was frustrating because it usually meant me trying something, him telling me I was a dope, did everything wrong, which is why I became a cartoonist because he couldn't. But what he did do is he was making me help him pack when we'd go on trips. And he'd show me how every centimeter of space could be used in a suitcase. And he would explain that this was important because if you ever have to bolt from Poland to Hungary in an attempt to escape the Nazis, it's good to take whatever you can fit in. But I found that the way I understand comics is similar. It's like it's a high act of compression, and you can do a lot with simple marks in a relatively small space if you use your space well. So,
and every mark should count.
Yeah, I think so. And I think something I mentioned before, this thing about rereading rather than reading, because you can do comics that like just pass through you and you never remember having read them, like, Drabble, is that what it's called? The one about the guy who lives in the cubicle? I don't know, daily strip, four panels, nobody. Everybody reads it. Nobody remembers it.
I read the New York Times. They don't do that.
but then now there's these newfangled graphic novels. I understand I'm one of its fathers, even though I'm demanding a blood test, because they basically are involved in decompression and making things go on as long as possible. And I'm interested in seeing how much you can pack in so that when one rereads, it opens up further for you.
Did your father, who was often putting you down, encourage you to become a cartoonist?
Oh, not at all.
He did buy you comics. You say he bought you some racy comics.
Yeah, well, that's because, see, like, comics for him were like dog whistles. He didn't hear them, which is, like I said, why I became a cartoonist. He saw how much I was spending of my allowance on these things. He said, I can get cheaper ones next to the Diamond Dealers District where I work. And he brought me comics that I'd never have seen because they'd been censored out of existence, the crime and horror and most lurid comic books that existed before that Comics Code moment. And he just bought them very blithely just because they were cheaper and a little beaten up, and it would be better than buying one for a dime. He could get three or four for a dime. And so I got a much better comics education than I would have otherwise.
And you include a comic strip in this book about asking your mother to buy you a Mad magazine when you were a kid. Now, Mad magazine, I think, probably influenced every cartoonist who came afterward, although it's hard to imagine that today.
Well, only because it's so pervasive. It really changed America and American humor in many ways. I think that kind of reflexive irony that is everywhere, including the news, not to mention, of course, the Daily Show and Colbert Report kind of news, really is born in that early Mad comics. And for me, that was the eye-opener that ruined my life, you know? Like, it just made me want to be a cartoonist. As I said in the introduction there, it's like Mad warped a generation in the bland American 1950s. It was saying something new. It was saying the media, the whole damn adult world is lying to you, and we here at Mad are part of the media.
But I get the feeling that Mad meant different things to different kids from different backgrounds. In your case, somebody who grew up as a child of immigrant parents felt like an outsider. This is a window into American culture and American humor.
Right. I got to learn everything through the refracted lens rather than directly. I would read the parody of The Raven and then get to find out about The Raven like 10 years later.
Who are some of the other influences? We've talked about a few, Mad, Crumb, etc. What about Woody Gelman, the creative director of Topps Gum?
Yeah, he was actually the good father, the mentor who came along and helped me into the world. He brought me into Topps Bubble Gum as a freelancer and working in various capacities where I ended up feeding back my Mad lessons as Wacky Packs and Garbage Pail Kids. But even more than that, he was a collector of paper ephemera at a time where this didn't exist. So he had a treasure trove of Little Nemo comics, Crazy Cat. He did the first book of Crazy Cat since the one that came out in the 40s. And his knowledge and appreciation of old comics like allowed me to seep his collection in and just learn it.
It's been my experience that the best comic writers, and I would think of Jules Pfeiffer as another example, are all historians of the form as well.
Yeah, you know, maybe it's true in lots of media that the future of the medium lies in its past, and it's only when you kind of go back and trace it back that the new work begins to, like, really burst out.
So a filmmaker probably knows a lot more about the history of cinema than anybody other than perhaps somebody who is an academic.
Well, that whole generation, all those French guys, you know, the Truffauts and the Godards, like, they were just digging back and saying, my God, this is a great film, and now I want to make my version of it, and it comes out shattered and new.
Let's talk a bit about Jack and the Box. Okay. And the Box. And most people who do books for kids are doing them because they have kids. But your kids are grown up, so you're not doing this with them in mind.
No, although it grew out of the insight that we had. Francoise is the publisher of Toon Books.
My wife. Francoise Mouly, who also does the covers of The New Yorker.
Yeah, she's the art editor of The New Yorker. But the thing is, this is a stupid thing to do, to publish oneself, but this is a new category, and it was impossible to get a regular publisher to buy into the hard work of creating a new slot in the bookstore of comics for 6- and 7-year-old kids when they're just learning to read. But both our kids, when they were young, I lost a great comics collection to, like, just letting them shred it and learn to read from it and love books, you know? So it was how I learned to read, and it's actually how I met Francoise. Like, she was trying to learn to read English, and she was asking about comics that could be interesting, and a friend steered her to Arcade magazine, the one I was doing at the time, and we met through that.
Well, kids' books usually are written by somebody, and then they get an illustrator.
Yeah.
But well, you're doing it kind of backward,
well, aren't
you? Well,
we're doing it. Some of the books are done with joining two people together. The main thing here, though, is it's not either an act of self-expression, as in the raw magazine comics or the ones in Breakdowns, nor is it just commerce, like trying to entertain. This is Francoise working with, like, teachers from Bank Street Books, going into schools and seeing how the intuition that comics can be useful in learning to read can be developed most fully without feeling like medicine, you know. But what we found now, because one of the people Francoise is working with is Barbara Tversky, who's a psychiatrist at Stanford who's interested in cog sci. And what she pointed out is when you learn to talk, your mother's hovering over you and she goes, "Oh, baby, would baby like some milk?" And she's acting out and you see the expressions on her face. She points to the milk, this arbitrary sound, milk, and you learn to make connections with it. And comics actually echo that process of acting things out, giving you facial expressions that are appropriate, showing you the objects when they're appropriate. And unlike see Dick run, run Dick run, oh Dick, oh run, you already got the kid running. You've seen it. If you've done all the work to like decode these squiggles underneath, it just tells you what you already know. And with comics, it's actually the dialogue. So it actually does give you a motive to want to understand what's happening.
I think there's also another side to this. For many years, comics were not respected. If a kid, usually smart kids, read those comic books and their parents wondered why they were wasting their time on them. And you've been, to some degree, a propagandist for comics as serving a higher role in our culture.
Well, and it's now come to pass. And in fact, the librarians, the very ones who would rip comics up back in the 40s and 50s, are the biggest boosters of comics in the libraries. And it's what's allowing this series to happen, because in bookstores, it's hard to know where to place them. Librarians care about this, put them in the right place somehow, and it's been happening because what this really does is, now that comics are no longer a pejorative, nobody's ever made comics for kids this young before.
And these two books are in odd sizes. Breakdowns is quite large. It's almost the size of a newspaper.
Yeah, it's the size of like what the old Life magazine used to be or something.
And Jack in the Box is much smaller.
6x8 horizontal landscape format, so you can read from left to right without having to go to a second tier of panels.
Breakdowns is published by Pantheon. Toon Books publishes Jack and the Box. And both of them are from Art Spiegelman. Art, thank you so much for being with us again.
Wow, thank you, Leonard. It's great, because when I get to finish a book, I come here and I get to like have the kind of relief of, oh, now it's done. I've been with Leonard.
And we did it from Mouse on.
Absolutely. And now I promise, I'm not very prolific. Even though I've got two books out now, it'll be a while before I kind of commandeer the microphone again.
Come back soon. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Leonard.